Traditionally, in Buddhism, there's the idea of a path, a marga, or a magga in Pali. And there are various depictions or descriptions of what the Buddhist path is like. And some of them are a little bit more technical in description, and some are a little bit maybe more poetic. One of the famous ones is the 10 ox herding pictures in Zen. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they have rather than ox, they have this idea of the elephant, these pictures of an elephant, and various stages of not the whole Buddhist path, the stages of of what happens in meditation. And there are many descriptions, and I'd like to offer you a new one today. And and I don't want you to take it too seriously, only seriously enough so that what's useful is useful for you. But not so seriously that you try to kind of shoehorn everything into this four stages of the path or meditation practice that I want to offer today. And so you won't take it too seriously. I'll tell you that the example comes from my son's kindergarten. And it has to do with the way that the kids in kindergarten were taught to work beeswax. And they'd come to school in the morning, and the beeswax would be quite cold. They'd be given a little block of beeswax. And the first thing they're taught to do is to hold the beeswax in their hand, both hands, hold it in their hands, and let their own body heat slowly warm the beeswax up. And after, I think sometimes the teacher would tell a story while they're just holding it. And after a while, the beeswax would get warm enough that you could start working it a little bit. And then the kids would start working it, kind of with their fingers and their hands, and kind of begin to stretch it and poke it and push it and kind of start working it until it got softer and softer and softer. And then eventually it becomes soft enough that they could shape it into something. And they'd make little sculptures out of their beeswax. And then when they finished making a sculpture, they'd put it on a shelf someplace and go off and run and play or do something else. So those are four stages. The first stage is warming it up. The second is softening it up. And then the third is shaping it. And the fourth is putting it on the shelf, releasing it from your hands. And I find that often when I come to sit down in meditation, it's useful to see the first period of meditation as the warming up time, kind of warming it up, and not to have a lot of big agendas or efforts of what you're going to do, what I'm going to do in meditation. To sit down, boom, okay, I'm going to enter into the fourth absorption just like that, you know. I'm going to sit here and enter the world of emptiness, you know, just cold, right? 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. It doesn't really work so well. It's kind of like taking the beeswax that's still hard and trying to pound it into shape. And rather than getting something soft and pliable that makes something beautiful with it, it just shatters. So sometimes if you try to force the mind, force the heart into some meditative state or some experience or some different state than it's at too quickly, it might just shatter. And I've known people who've done that, who've kind of had experiences kind of shattering their mind in some way because they pushed so hard in their meditation practice when it wasn't appropriate. And I think it's often nice at the beginning of practice, beginning of a retreat, maybe sometimes the first day of the retreat, beginning of a meditation session, sometimes the first 5 minutes or some period of time, to have the idea that you're just showing up and keeping it warm, warming the mind, warming the heart. And you're not really trying to do anything. And part of that is just kind of bringing yourself in its presence and then holding what your experience is in a warm-hearted way, in a warm-handed way. And that can mean a variety of things. But one of the things it can mean is a certain degree of acceptance. That the first task of meditation is to start where we're at and to acknowledge where we're at, acknowledge what's going on, and then to have a certain degree of acceptance of that. It doesn't mean you're condoning it, or it doesn't mean you're going to forever going to let it just be there, but kind of some a broad-mindedness or open-heartedness or some spaciousness or graciousness, generosity for what is there. Okay, there's there, regardless of what it is. And in some sense, the more uncomfortable it is, maybe more initially what it needs is that broad acceptance or a presence that just kind of feels it and is there for it. I remember when my son was quite young, it was like a baby. There were some times where he cried inconsolably. And couldn't figure out what it was. We tried all the various things to figure out what he needed. Sometimes people say maybe it was colic or something, but we tried to help him. And the only thing that, seemed to make any sense was to hold him. And we'd hold him, and he'd cry and cry. And then very, very slowly, he would relax and relax and relax. And then eventually, he'd be okay and he'd go to sleep. But, the task of the parent then was just to hold the child with acceptance. And I wasn't going to give him a lecture about how, whatever. And so to hold something, to hold yourself, and part of this idea of holding yourself with warm hands is at the beginning, especially the beginning of meditation, but maybe for a long time in meditation practice, it's best not to have the idea that you're supposed to do a good job. The trap of being a good meditator is a really big trap. And to have a really high standard of how you're going to measure your meditation is a big trap also. And rather, the idea of good enough is good enough is really important for meditation. You don't have to do 100% in order to get the benefits of meditation. And the analogy for this is if you want to drain your bathtub, it doesn't matter if you pull the plug all the way out of the drain or you crack it a little bit. Eventually the water will drain out either way. It'll take longer if it just cracked, but it eventually will drain. And so in same thing in meditation, you don't have to kind of have this, dynamic dynamo kind of meditation that is going to empty that mind as quickly as possible. But rather, if you show up and do the best you can, sometimes being a little bit sloppy in meditation actually is better than being tight and trying to do a perfect job. So be kind of generous about yourself and not be so concerned about how well you're doing. Being concerned, too concerned about how well you're doing is kind of like... Well, the example is often given is that the farmer going out in her field and wants to see how the corn is growing. Is it really growing well? And so she pulls a seedling out of the ground to look at it. Oh yeah, it's going really well. But then you can't plant it back in again. So to be too concerned about how well we're doing in meditation and measuring all the time is not really that helpful. So there's an initial phase. Of kind of holding it in our warm hands. And my suggestion is that means many different things, depending on what's needed. Sometimes the warm hands is the warm hands of compassion, just having compassion for what is. Sometimes the warm hands are the warm hands of forgiveness, being forgiving for what is, forgiveness for what is, or forgiving for how difficult it is and for our foibles. Sometimes it's doing loving kindness practice, offering kindness to what's here, and that's just kind of what's holding it in the warm hands. But somehow the psyche, to offer something to the psyche, to the inner life, to the heart, to the mind, that it helps it to soften, relax, and warm up. And sometimes the way we relate to ourselves can be so self-critical, and so in various ways. That it just keeps it kind of the mind brittle and tight. It's kind of defensive and upset and afraid. And it's afraid of its own. Sometimes we can be afraid of our own inner critic because it's just so unkind. So to find some way to drop the inner critic or the inner self criticism, and begin kind of letting some kind of thawing happen of the tight mind, the hard mind, the brittle mind, the fragile mind. That often exists. And to some degree this is very important because for people who live compulsive lives, obsessive lives, which in the Buddhist analysis is most people, If it isn't, you know, obsessive and compulsive about certain things, it's certainly about our thoughts. But if you're always kind of living, kind of chasing after thoughts, chasing after plans, chasing after doing things, or always living in a world of resistance and fear, or feeling threats everywhere, or whatever it might be, that activity of the mind does make the mind hard and kind of tight. And so we need to find some way to begin softening it, and to try to force it to be soft is just going to shatter it. So very broad. So you find sometimes in Vipassana circles emphasis on mindfulness. Mindfulness being this very broad, accepting presence that just holds what is there, doesn't try to get rid of anything, but just allows everything to be as it is and just holds it in awareness. Now, this part of the practice of holding it with warm hands is often a time of tremendous learning for people, because one of the things we learn as we try to do that is how difficult it is even just to hold our experience with some kindness or some warmth or some just kind of acceptance right now. There can be so much lack of acceptance going on in our mind. Let's have a little different one. Thank you. It's nice. It's nice when they have nice little songs. It's better than the old one where they just ring. So often a lot of learning goes on, and we learn about the reactivity of the mind. We learn about how difficult it is to stay present in a kind way, or accepting way, or forgiving way, and that's a very important part of a stage of the practice, is to learn about all this activity of the mind, all the way it makes it difficult for us to stay present in a kind way and be present. And so those very difficulties are maybe the very things that need our warmth and our kindness. In this initial stage, the very things that make it difficult for us to be present represent the very things that need to be offered love, compassion, presence, mindfulness, to be seen there. So again, that which makes it difficult to be present should not be pushed away or criticized or considered to be unfortunate. They might be the very things that need to be included into, so we can kind of soften the beeswax of the mind. But sooner or later, the mind begins to relax or to warm up. Sooner or later, and so at that point, it makes sense to start talking about working the mind. And so working the mind here is begin softening it, massaging it, so we can kind of stretch it and make it softer. You can, if you only hold it warm in your hands, then it's only so far. You know, might be some people are satisfied with just keep. You know, if they have the beeswax and they're warming it in their hands, after a while it feels really nice. It has a nice texture, a little bit. It's got a smooth surface. It's nice and warm. And some people are content with that. That's good enough. And so they okay. They hold that in their hand for a while. So some people in meditation practice, at this initial stage of just acceptance and warmth and holding it there, some people get content with that because it feels nice. It kind of comes to a place where it feels kind of good. But there's more that can be done. And the mind can be worked. The mind can be developed. The mind can be stretched and softened even further. And so one of the ways of beginning to soften the mind further is to begin massaging it, working it. And so concentration practice is one of those ways, or having some kind of more discipline about trying to keep the mind in the present moment. And so kind of pushing a little bit the edge of your ability to stay present and hold the mind in the present moment, hold the mind on the breath, or whatever the object of the concentration is. Now, as we're trying to develop concentration in the present moment, I think the idea of kneading the beeswax is a very good analogy. Because you don't just take the beeswax and just hold it and expect it to get soft. You kind of work it. You push down on it and you release. You push down on it and release. So the same thing with the mind is that you don't just hold the mind concentrated. You just, okay, there it is. There's the breath. I'm going to, you know, hold it there. And that's often kind of the unconscious idea that people have. Okay, I'm supposed to be concentrated and, oh, that didn't work. I'll try again. Didn't work. But rather than having some kind of idea that you're supposed to be perfect at doing the concentration thing, maybe it's good to see it as it's a process of beginning to knead the mind, massaging the mind. And And what will happen is that you'll apply your mind, your attention to the object concentration, and sooner or later, your mind will wander off. That wandering off can be seen as part of the rhythm of kneading, of massaging the mind. So when it wanders off, it's a part of the phase of that rhythm, that cycle. It needs to happen, almost. It's a nice policy, a nice view to say, but it almost needs to happen. The mind needs to wander off as you're developing concentration, because you need that rhythm of the mind. So rather than being upset when the mind wanders off, say, oh, the pendulum has now swung. Now the rhythm, that's where that part of the cycle right now, where the mind wanders off. As soon as you notice that, your job is to come back onto the breath again and to be focused again. But to do it with a sense of it's a rhythm that you're playing with, you're working with, as opposed to something to be reactive to, upset about, and not something to jerk your mind back from. When the mind wanders off away from the breath, some people get upset, they get kind of hard again, some people kind of pounce back at the breath, they jerk their mind around, come back here. But think of it as a rhythm. The mind goes off, and then with a gentle way, you're going to kind of let the pendulum, the rhythm, kind of come back. Kind of like the waves on the shore. Okay, now I'm going to go back on the breath. So we don't, then stay with the breath. And then we stay on the breath, try to stay there the best we can, kind of pushing the limit of how long we can stay there, rest there, how long we can rest there. The idea is to rest on the breath, rest on the object of attention. And then sooner or later, the mind will wander off again, and then let the rhythm come back. Now, part of why this is a useful idea, I think, is that in order to develop concentration, which is a very important part of Buddhist practice, it's not done so much by an act of will. Act of will can very often lead to making the mind tight again or hard again, make it cold again. It's rather best to see that concentration requires two elements. It requires resting the mind on the object of concentration. So rather than fixating the mind, it's resting the mind on the object of concentration. And then letting go of everything that prevents you from staying there. And letting go is in contrast to holding everything else at bay. It's letting go. So resting and then letting go. Letting go is supposed to be softening, relaxing. So when the mind does wander off, it's important to let go of that so you can come back to your object of concentration. But you let go of it with softly, gently. It's kind of let go into softness. And kind of let it swing back gently. So you begin to, the idea of you working the mind. The mind is not a fixed thing. It's quite malleable. It can be quite malleable once it gets soft. And we're trying to soften it even more. So the description of a concentrated mind in Buddhism is one that's soft, pliable, malleable, and workable. Isn't that great? You realize your mind is that way? So trying to stay in the present moment, coming back to the present moment, trying to get concentrated or just being focused in what we're doing, can be seen as a part of the practice that's beginning to soften the mind much further than you can get if you're just keeping it warm. So stretching the mind, developing it. And that takes time. It takes a sense of rhythm and a lot of patience and a lot of acceptance, kind of working it. Sometimes it takes a long time to do it. Sometimes it can go quicker, depending on how hot things are, I guess, or whatever. But, that's part of the stage of practice. Sometimes you can see the difference in the mind getting softer or more concentrated in one sitting. Sometimes it's over several months of sitting every day, you can start seeing some change. Sometimes on retreat, you see it after a few days, perhaps, or after a few retreats. It varies from person to person. There's no one right way of doing it. Now, this effort of softening the mind, relaxing the mind, also has its challenges. And that is that as the mind gets softer and softer, as the heart gets softer, there are various places in the heart, in the mind, that are kind of crusted over. And sometimes as it gets softer, some of the crusts break off. And then they kind of travel through the mental circulatory system. stroke. Yeah, you get a spiritual stroke. Danger. Oh, so dangerous. You know what the Ramdas said after he got his stroke? He said, "Oh, I've been stroked by God." And so sometimes things get dislodged, that process of softening. And so sometimes it's a bit of a surprise at old memories come back, or you realize old animosities or fears or different kind of things kind of that we often haven't seen for a long time and haven't really addressed will bubble up and show itself. And sometimes it's a big surprise because practice is going well. Person's feeling getting concentrated, feeling quite open, feeling having a lot of good feelings. And then they feel like they're kind of sometimes sideswiped by, where'd that come from? You know, I was doing just fine. Suddenly, the next sitting, the next day, I sat down to sit, and suddenly there's this big issue that's come up. And a big thing's come up, and I must be going backwards in my meditation practice. How can this be? And when things get dislodged, we're not going backwards. It's just with the purification process is going on. We're getting purified. So this stage of concentrating the mind, working the mind, is often called the purification stage. And there's often a lot of stuff that needs to be purified. And in the body, in the heart, in the mind. And so at any one of these stages, sometimes it's useful to go back to the first stage. Something gets dislodged. Oh, maybe it's time to go back and just hold what's been dislodged in my warm hands with acceptance. Maybe that's what's needed now. This hard little crust has appeared. That hard crust needs to be softened. So I need to practice forgiveness, loving kindness, compassion, acceptance, just holding it. And if you kind of think you're supposed to just kind of stay with the concentration practice when something's been dislodged, you're asking for trouble. You have to go back to stage one. It's like Monopoly. Not like that, no. That's a bad example. So at some point, this process, the mind gets really soft and pliable, workable. At that point, you can actually begin shaping the mind. And this is where the mind, you can actually be doing things with the mind that you can't do if the mind is hard and brittle. And so one of the things you start doing with the mind, for example, there's a variety of things you can do, but all of them have to do with deepening the practice even further. One of the things to do is to start entering into deeper states of concentration. And one of the ways that this is done is at this particular point of practice, when the mind is soft and warm and really workable, and the mind has access to a lot of sense, a lot of happiness, a lot of joy, a lot of sense of well-being. And so then, to allow that well-being that arises from a soft mind to begin pulling you into the world of greater well-being, greater joy, greater happiness, and to such a way that you get absorbed, the mind gets absorbed in this process of tremendous well-being. And it's a lot easier for the mind to get absorbed. Like reading a really good novel, it's a really great book, you really love it, you feel really good, you get absorbed in it, you forget everything else. Time stops, the outside world stops, someone calls your name, you don't even hear it, you're so absorbed. At some point in meditation, when this feeling of well-being is so powerful, that you get so involved in it that you're kind of absorbed like reading a good book. The advantage of this is not because we want to indulge in joy and happiness, is that it helps the mind become stiller and stiller. It helps the mind become more and more quiet, more still. And being quiet and still is not important in and of itself, but quiet and stillness allows us to see more deeply what is. And that's kind of the quest in Buddhist practice, is to be able to see as deeply or clearly as you can the depths of the mind, the depth of experience, the depth of life. And that still mind is one of the ones that can see the best. And so it just happens to be that part of the process of stilling mind goes through a period of a tremendous sense of meditative well-being, of joy. Isn't that good news? As a person can see more clearly and more deeply as the mind gets stiller and quieter, very soft, very open, very still mind, then we shape it into something quite beautiful, the mind. And then at some point, when it's shaped beautifully, when the mind is relaxed, when the mind is still enough that there's very little attachment, very little clinging in the mind, which is a big order, because a tall order, because the normal human mind, the way it's almost like the way it's structured, is to be structured with a certain degree of clinging or Velcro in it. And so to begin having the mind still enough to let go of our clinging, so the mind's not clinging to anything, not clinging to any sense of self, self-identity, not clinging to pleasure, not clinging to security, not clinging to pleasure. There's a lot, just letting go of all kinds of clinging. Letting go of the clinging to know, letting go of the clinging to be right, letting go of the clinging for success and failure, all kinds of clingings you have to let go of. The mind, and as we let go of this clinging, the mind gets softer and softer. And then in the kindergarten example of working with the beeswax, the kids eventually make something beautiful and they put it up on the shelf. They release their object. At some point, we release the mind, or the mind releases itself. And to have the mind release itself is the experience of nirvana or nibbana or liberation in Buddhism. When the mind can release itself, there's no more. The mind doesn't even hold to itself. So it's kind of the final or ultimate level of letting go. It's hard to let go at that ultimate level, just cold. You sit down, when you're cold. But there's this whole process of working the mind, working ourselves, and eventually we release it. And then when the mind is released, the mind, in a sense, it's difficult to describe that experience, but to have a mind which is unlocalized, to have an awareness which is unlocalized, undirected, unbounded, unlimited, to have a mind which is just completely open, so open that it doesn't even see itself. So, I offered four different stages, and each of those stages is great. And to think that the stage you're at is not great, or not the best, is probably a symptom of the mind getting cold again, getting hard. But to be content and happy with the stage you're at is a symptom of the mind getting warmer and softer. So wherever you're at, whether it's the first sitting, the first tremendous turmoil and difficulty, and you sit down to meditate, and you just need a lot of broad acceptance for that, and a broad container of compassion, or whether the mind is pristine and quiet and just boundless. It's all great. It's all the practice is great. The practice of meeting that is great. And to have confidence in one's practice, that one has a practice that you can engage your life wherever it's at, can offer a lot of hope, a lot of confidence, a lot of encouragement, and can lead to a sense, oh yeah, it's all good, wherever I'm at. And I think for most people, that the spiritual path is spirals, it goes back and forth, there's a rhythm to it. There's times when the rhythm swings around and we have to sit with tremendous difficulties, brittleness and hardness. At times when the pendulum swings, we sit with great freedom and openness. And to be very, very relaxed about the rhythm of that, just like I talked about the rhythm of working the mind to get concentrated. So I think there's large rhythms that last over days and weeks and months and years. And to realize that actually part of the art of spiritual life is to be able to work the various rhythms, and that things kind of swing a little bit back and forth. And you're working that, and that you're working that at the micro level, and you're working the rhythms at the macro level. And over time, things will get warmer and warmer. In that kind of way, when we talk about something being warm-hearted, that kind of warmth. So, so much for kindergarten. So what do you think of that? Do you have any questions or comments about that analogy or that kind of teaching?
I have a question about this putting the figure on the mantle.
Yeah.
And then your son goes home, and the next day he starts working with the clay again. Is that what happens in practice too?
Oh, in the kindergarten, I guess, I don't know what happens when they finish making something. Sometimes they bring them home. And we used to have things on our shelf at home. And I don't know what happens to those things. Some things get saved, and some things, I think they're, my wife has this mysterious way of, you know, she does something with some of the, we have, you know, she didn't do something with some of this artwork that we have so much, I mean, piles and piles of mysterious things happen. And so I'm not sure what happened to all that beeswax. It's been released. But why do you ask the question?
In practice, what happens? I mean, you go through and your mind becomes melt, softer.
Yeah.
And then you reach a state.
Sorry.
It's like the book about, you know, the laundry is the next day, or
after the ecstasy, the laundry.
Yeah, right. And but it's also that it's not permanent. There's an impermanence about even that state. So that's the question.
Well, yes
I
and
have.
No. Some of the more profound states that can happen in meditation practice or in spiritual life. Can have a permanent effect. So, like, you know, if I mean, there's a variety of ways of seeing that. I mean, one is that if you never knew that putting your foot in the ocean would make your foot wet, you know, you read a book and that's what it said. It does. But then you finally go and you put your foot in the ocean. You know, it really does make it wet. Look at that. And then you know it from your own experience. And then you leave, and then you're always changed in the way that now you always have that clear understanding that putting your foot in the ocean makes it wet. There's can be a very clear realization about truth that will stay with you. That realization can stay with you forever. There can also be very deep insights into the nature, the working of your own mind, that you'll never see your mind the same way again. You'll never be fooled again. So, you know, if you can be endlessly fascinated by a magician's trick until you're told how the trick is done. And then you get bored really quickly. You lose interest. So the mind is kind of like a magician. And so as long as you don't know how the trick is done, we're fascinated by the ego. But once you can kind of see through the ego and see how the trick is done, you're not going to be so fascinated anymore. And you'll go on to more interesting things. Certain things are... When the mind goes deep enough, or quiet enough, or peaceful, and it gets released enough, then some of the common forms of clinging or the drives of the mind that a person might have are also seen through, and some of those common drives begin to lessen, or sometimes it's been said completely disappear in a person who's deeply realized from that deep experience. So there's meant to be, the deep experience in Buddhism, the deepest experiences, are not meant to be experiences for their own right. They're meant to be experiences that change us. And that change is hopefully permanent. Yes? In the back there, please. Oh, yeah, wait for the mic if you don't mind.
When you talk about meditation and let your mind go and so on, what happens if you deal with situation, people always bring the battle in your doorstep. Okay, you try to let it go, and let go, and let it flow through you. And it's like a rope. You let the tension out a bit. People pull the rope. You know, you let the slack go. They pull the slack and then try to pull some more. You kept letting go, and then and get to the point that you're at the end of your rope. How you let the other person have the whole rope, and then how do you get to the point that I say, can I say it? Up to the point, say, screw this, and I'm going back. and I guess I'm just not being able to meditate deep enough. How do you get, you know, when you get to that stage, how do you bring yourself back?
Well, it's hard to know without knowing exact examples. It's a little bit hard to know what to say, but the I think it's important to realize that letting go, that has, it's such an important part of Buddhist practice, is not meant to be letting go of things in the world per se, but rather letting go of a particular way that we relate to things in the world. So if I'm attached to my glass of water and clinging to it, I don't have to kind of get rid of it, the glass of water, to let go of it. I can still keep it up here and use it, but what I let go of is the clinging in my mind, my attachment to the having my mind. So it's a movement of the mind that we let go of. So in a real world situation where you're having conflict with someone else, you might not. What you want to look at is, where is the clinging? Where is the attachment in my own mind here that I have to let go of? That's a healthy letting go for me. If it's not healthy to let go, then watch out. But is it healthy for me to let go of? And then once I've let go, then can I relate to this person in the appropriate way? An appropriate way might be in long before you reach the end of your rope and say, no, you can't do that. But you do it with a relaxed mind. Because you don't necessarily let go of the situation. You let go of your attitude about the situation. And then the situation might require you to be quite strict. Maybe. But it's not a battle in your mind. So but what you do interpersonally requires a lot of wisdom. So maybe you don't say no. Maybe you say, can we talk about this a little bit? You know, can we sit down and talk a little bit about what's going on here? Or I've noticed that if I continue letting you have your way, that sooner or later I explode. And it's not good for everyone, including you, if I reach the point where I explode. So before that point, could we sit down and talk a little bit? Would you be willing to talk to me about this?
Way past that.
So I mean, this, you know, real world situations, it's hard to know. So the Buddha gave some advice about when to speak. One of them had to do: you should always speak with kindness, speak the truth, and you should, and if it's useful. And if you can't talk to someone, if you know talking to someone is not useful, then maybe don't waste your effort. Sometimes we bring mediators in, facilitators in to help us in the conversation. Sometimes we write letters. You know, the wisdom in order to deal with real life situations is complex. We need a lot of wisdom. But what the Buddhist practitioner does first and foremost, in a sense, is they watch their own mind, their own heart, so that's clean. And that whatever we decide to do, at least we know that our heart is clean in the action we have to do. Okay? Okay. So, Wendy?
Can you apply the same technique to opening your heart to compassion? To cultivating compassion?
I would think so, yeah. If you feel there's something that needs compassion, that perhaps in the beginning you don't want to rush in to be compassionate if it's hard, but rather the first thing to do is just to hold the experience, hold what's going on, and take it in. Because compassion arises, for the most part, compassion arises out of our contact with suffering. And so we have to allow the suffering in and to really, really have an impact on us. And until it has a healthy impact on us, a healthy compassion is probably not going to arise. And so so maybe the first stage, you know, is just, okay, there's a suffering happening here, and let me just hold it here in my hands for a while. And then once it's there for a while, then maybe we can start working the compassion. And
is concentration an integral part of meditation, or is it just like priming the pump, and then you meditate afterwards?
The answer depends. There are so many different kinds of meditation. It's like sport, right? There's, you say, if you ask a question, do all, you know, is having a, I don't know what to say. There's so many different kinds of sports, so it's hard to generalize. You know, is having a ball integral to all sports? No. So is concentration integral to all meditation? It's kind of hard to answer that question. So you have to find out what meditation you're talking about. In Buddhist meditation, generally, concentration is an integral part always, because the ability to be concentrated is an integral part of the mind, and so we want to use that ability. In the different schools of Buddhism, there's a difference between how much concentration is considered necessary. So some schools will say a lot of concentration is important. Some schools will say you don't have to focus on concentration at all. Whatever concentration you need will follow naturally as you do the mindfulness meditation. Some schools of Buddhism say start with concentration, get really concentrated, and then switch over to a different kind of meditation once you have that strong concentration going. There's different strategies. So I don't know if that was...
Well, I'm talking about the concentration the meditation that we are doing here.
Yeah. Yes.
Presumably, we're all doing something similar
right.
here.
Right. Here. And here, concentration is an integral part of mindfulness. They're like two wings of a bird. You need to have both mindfulness and concentration. However, if you focus primarily on mindfulness and do it diligently, concentration will follow in its wake. And so the general tendency in our movement here, our kind of meditation here, is to focus on developing mindfulness. But as we develop the mindfulness, there's concentration that comes along. But some people, the concentration doesn't come along fast enough or doesn't get strong enough. So sometimes people then will cultivate concentration practice separate from the mindfulness. And that's what I'm teaching Wednesday nights right now. I'm teaching a concentration class, partly for that reason.
Thank you.
So last one.
What's the difference between mindfulness and concentration?
Concentration is generally holding the mind or resting the mind on one thing without necessarily being concerned about what that thing is. Just holding the mind there. And as the mind is held there, the subjective state of our experience can change, because everything gets oriented or unified or integrated in that one path, that one direction of focusing on something. Mindfulness practice involves seeing clearly what is. So it has to do with having insight or seeing. So rather than just holding the mind and not really seeing what's there, it's seeing what's there really clearly. Oh, that's what. So if I'm focusing on this glass, I can get concentrated on this glass without really knowing the details. But I can also be mindful of it and be aware of its shape and its texture and what's in it and the drops of water, and really study it and get to know different aspects of it. So mindfulness is a process of knowing and knowing more and more deeply. Concentration is a process of stilling and getting stiller and stiller in the mind as it holds something fixed. And the two work very well together, because if you want to be able to see clearly something, the mind has to be still enough to be focused. If there isn't some degree of concentration, you'll bring your attention to look at something and it'll immediately go off and think about something else or do something else. So you need to have some concentration. So with mindfulness meditation, ideally, concentration and mindfulness are paired and they're working together as partners. So, thank you.